Pastor Wagenglass, does that still work for you to be able to share screen? If you could pull up Exhibit A2. And I believe it's on page 9 of the PDF. Yep. Mr. Jenkins, can you see that the document that's up?
Yes.
Can you tell us what that is, please?
Yeah, so that I believe is the first one of the first inspection reports that I submitted based on this operation. As I mentioned in my last statement there, this is a one of the pre-notifications. So I had to submit this after the notification was submitted in the Fern system. But to document that, when it had went in there and documented that. This indicates, you know, that myself and the ODF Geotech conducted that inspection. You can see there on January 3rd. What we're doing with this is providing the operator, landowner, you know, if we see any issues or potential issues, we can provide them with recommendations on how to mitigate that. In this case, during the Geotech review, it was simply to note that we're going through that process. And also noted that, you know, there's no other activities associated with that harvest that were out of compliance at the time.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Wagenglass, if we could turn next to Exhibit A4. Mr. Jenkins, do you recognize this document?
I do, yep. This is the memo that Mr. Beering sent to myself following that visit, following our visit there to the site on January 3rd. You supplied this a couple days later, I believe on or about the 5th of January. And this was his summary of his findings, providing public risk recommendations associated with any homes in the vicinity of the harvest, and outlined what areas of that harvest would require any harvest restrictions based on those public safety concerns.
And we'll have Mr. Beering testify to this in more detail, but can you tell us, once you received this, what did you do with this information?
Yeah, so this is, as I mentioned, you know, this is you know, some information that I didn't quite have the expertise to tease out. So with this, my intent there and what I did afterwards was shared that with Sam Howard, Stimson Forester. The goal there was to provide him the information that the Geotech had found, delineating where those harvest restrictions were going to be, and what additional requirements were going to be associated with that. In this case, And I know you said Mr. Beering will testify to that later, but part of that was with a substantial rating, for example, is a harvest restriction or a buffer area or harvest area with no allowed harvesting of those trees in addition to a wind firm buffer. So that was primarily one of the bits of information that I needed from the Geotech review to then further assist Stimson in implementing a plan that would be successful in protecting those resources, protecting those areas, and that's why I did that.
And you mentioned the harvest restrictions. Are those stated in rule based on what the analysis here finds?
Yes, those are in our high landslide hazard public safety risk rules.
So a geotechnical review that comes to a result of substantial then leads to a particular harvesting restriction that's stated in the rule. Am I getting that right?
Yes, correct.
And if we could then turn to Exhibits A5 and Was this a part of the email from Mr. Buehring?
This was, yes. So during the one of the pre-operation inspections with Sam Howard, we had discussed some potential ground-based operations in the unit, and I had mentioned that to Mr. Buehring. Given that it was a preliminary inspection, we were just discussing all possible components of the operation. So I wanted to check with him on what requirements would be there. Further discussion with the forester, with the Simpson forester there, led to no intent to operate ground-based machinery, which is the guidance here and in Exhibit 5. Essentially, this was an added bit of information, but something that we ultimately didn't need to incorporate into the harvest plan or written plan.
Because those units were not going to be harvested, is that why it didn't need to be incorporated?
Those areas with steep slopes, we're not going to have the ground-based operations on them.
They were going to have either no harvest or it was going to be a skyline harvest. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. Yes.
And if we could then turn to Exhibit A6, please. And does this Exhibit A6 look familiar to another part of what was attached to Mr. Buehring's email?
Yep, that was the map that he provided, delineating the homes associated with his memo there, as well as identifying the basins and areas for harvest restrictions. You'll see there area C, A, and E were those areas that he had identified as needing harvest restrictions, and areas D and B did not require any. Meaning that all areas in those two basins wouldn't have any harvest restrictions, and timber could be harvested out of there.
And can you identify that it may be hard to see, but there's some homes labeled with numbers attached to them. Can you help us identify some of those homes?
Easiest way probably there is starting at the top. Home 7 would be the Lund residence, which is we haven't quite discussed yet, but as part of this, that home is where the water right point of diversion is located. That is a home adjacent to Mr. Krall's residence as well. The other subsequent homes, 6 through 1, are actually on another access road, as those basins drain away from home 7 there. These areas were approximately around home 5 is where that Simpson property is that Mr. Buehring and I accessed to review some of that. Some of those components there associated with the public safety risk.
Okay. And is Mr. Krall's property visible on this, or is it just to the north of Mr. Lund's house?
It is not visible on this map. No, it's just to the north there, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Reidenglass, for getting that turn so we don't crane our necks. I appreciate that. If we could then turn to Exhibit 8. Can you tell us what this document is?
Absolutely. This is another inspection report from another pre-inspection. So again, this occurred before final notification of the operation. Myself and Samuel Howard met on site at the unit. Primary goal there was to go over on the ground those recommendations that Mr. Beering had supplied in his report, primarily looking at the harvest restriction areas in those three drainages that he had identified. We looked at those which had been buffered to ensure they met the requirements. There was two in question that had an intermediate rating, which included, which required just that area to be restricted in harvest. And then those with substantial, as I mentioned before, were going to require an additional buffer around what was identified in Mike's report. That intent there is to include a wind firm buffer, so that the intent there is to provide that the trees that are being retained or required to be retained in those high landslide area hazard areas, they're reduced the likelihood that those are going to be impacted by wind. And so those are, that wind firm buffer is a sacrificial buffer, essentially, in an effort that should something of that nature happen, it's not going to impact those high landslide hazard areas. So Samuel, I, Mr. Howard and I met and looked at that primarily, walked the main drainages associated with those harvest limitations, looking at those buffers before I left. And again, there noted no operations that had compliance. Everything that we discussed and looked at there had met those recommendations from Mr. Beering and all rule sets that I was concerned with. And what I mean by that is we also discussed the, you know, some of the streams in the unit and with the cable harvest operations and the steeper slopes. Really wanted to make sure we focused on protecting the streams as well. And so we talked about the measures there, which entailed in some areas fully suspending the logs during harvest operations. All that information, you know, we discussed in our effort to allow Samuel to put together what we call a non-statutory written plan that addresses those operations in an HLHL harvest restriction or an HLHL area that has harvest restrictions. And so after that visit, Samuel was able to put that plan together and submit that notification.
Can you tell us what an HLHL is?
HLHL is the high landslide hazard location. So those are the steeper slopes above 80% primarily, and then as well some there may be some restrictions for slopes between 60% to 80%.
And you mentioned the non-statutory written plan. Is that the document that is in Exhibit 8-9? If we could turn to 8-9 next.
Correct. Yes. This is the non-statutory written plan submitted by Stanley Howard when he submitted that notification of operations.
Okay. So this document, the January 25th, 2022, titled Written Plan in Exhibit A9, this was Stimson's plan for how it would conduct operations in light of the geotechnical review and the landslide issues. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. The intent with this plan is given the nature of the high landslide hazard locations and risk ratings that were associated with that review, it's required that the operation the operator provides the non-statutory written plan here, delineating the protection measures for those areas that require harvest limitations, how they're going to protect those areas, including that wind firm buffer, which was addressed here in the plan, any other issues that could potentially contribute to that, such as skyline corridors or anything like that, was also addressed. Ultimately, the intent here is to provide that information so that Stewardship Forester can be assured that the operation is going to meet the requirements of the Forest Practices Act.
Did you share this plan with Mr. Buren to have him look at it from the geotechnical perspective?
I did. Yes, given his expertise in the area, I just wanted to share that with him to make sure there was no concerns that he had and that we didn't miss anything and that could be implemented without any issues. He did provide me with a response that it appeared to meet the requirements and all of his recommendations that he had, which I was in agreement, but like I said, wanted to check with him as well.
Great. And following the written plan, there's Exhibit C with three different maps. Were those the maps attached to the written plan?
Correct. The first there would be A9, page 204. That was the harvest map supplied with the wind firm or with the buffers and the leaf areas. Red indicating the substantial harvest limitation areas. Green hash marks the harvest. Or the buffer, excuse me, and then yellow indicating the intermediate areas. Page 304 of that document was again the harvest plan and associated with those areas and the associated skyline corridors. And then the final 404 there delineating or overlaying the same information that Mr. Buren had provided, indicating those basin areas. Which he had broken out in his review process.
Yeah, and this written plan is, does ODF consider it to be a non-statutory written plan? Is that right?
Yes, this is a non-statutory written plan. There's a number of different tools through the FDA to, as I mentioned, to help share communication with the operator and Stewardship Forester to make sure all resource protection measures are met. This is one of those tools. This one is unique in that it doesn't require a public comment period. It's simply to share that information with the Stewardship Forester and increase that conversation around those areas that could have potential risk to resources. That's a document again that was used, and with that, we don't approve these. You know, it's called a plan, but we don't approve these plans. We, being the state, or myself as a Stewardship Forester, we merely use this document and provide comment that it would either meet or potentially provide some comments that it wouldn't meet and how it might better suit. Or how it might be better tailored to suit the conditions to make sure that plan is fully implemented to meet the Forest Practices Act.
So if you were to provide comments back on this plan, making recommendations for different protections, is the operator obligated to follow your recommendation?
They are. In essence, you know, those comments are designed to those comments that I would provide are designed to aid the operator in conducting that operation in a manner that would meet the Forest Practices Act. So I guess I answered a little quickly. So they're not obligated to follow them, but they are obligated to meet the rule set. So as long as the activity meets the protection requirements, then they would be sufficient and adequate.
And if they didn't follow the recommendations and it resulted in resource damage, then the consequence would be what?
The consequence, we could provide a citation for that. We could follow the process where damage has occurred in that sense, and cite that activity as having failed to meet the requirements provided in rule.
Okay, thank you. If we could turn next to Exhibit A10, can you tell us what this document is?
Yes. So this is the notification of operations that was submitted by Stimson, by Sam Howard there on January 26th. So this is shortly thereafter our second meeting there to look at that to look at the buffers and that following that discussion there. This provides various information which is required to you for any harvest operation to be provided to a state forester, and this document is designed to capture that, primarily information including landowner, timber owner, harvest plan, the non-statutory written plan in A9 that we were just looking at there was submitted at that time with this document, so it accompanied that. And this is a tool that we use to then track that operation throughout its life. As you look through there further, A10 page 2, you'll notice there at the top, this is another method to continue that conversation. So the first, I guess the fourth there, the fourth paragraph, was a comment from myself to on this notification dated 2/4/22. That was a response to that statutory written plan, or sorry, to the non-statutory written plan that was submitted with the harvest notification there. And this is again that tool or one of the methods that Stewardship Forestry uses to provide those recommendations, provide those comments on plans, or share any pertinent information associated with that proposed harvest operation. So as you'll note there, in that same paragraph, indicated all streams are small type N, and so that's something that was determined during the review process that I conducted once this notification came in.
Did you find any type D streams or domestic use streams in the area?
I did find one domestic use point of diversion or stream in the area during that review process. I determined based on the information we had that it was not associated or not in a location associated with this harvest operation. And by that I mean there was primarily two stream drainages, one that drained from the harvest unit itself down towards one of the residents in that review from Mr. Bearing. And a second drainage to the north of that that did not drain out of the harvest unit in question, and it is that northern drainage that had the mapped point of diversion that allowed me to determine that at the time that it was that the stream in the unit was not a domestic use stream.
Okay, and before we get any further into the domestic use stream, I did want to just go back to your comments on the non-statutory plan. This was where you provided comments back to Stimson on whether you felt that their non-statutory written plan for the sloped lands was going to be adequate. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
And did you have any recommendations for them that were different from what they had proposed in their non-statutory plan?
No, I didn't have any recommendations beyond what they had proposed. As I mentioned earlier, Part of that discussion had kind of encircled around any ground-based activities, which we do have rule sets to manage. And so in that, the only comment I made in addition to that was of such, indicating that if any, or not to operate any ground-based machinery on those HLHL slopes. But other than that, maintain those buffered areas for the high landslide areas identified in the geotech review and the written plan, just as a an adage there, as that was the primary focus of that written plan, and I wanted to ensure that was maintained and followed through with.
So then getting back to the protected resources and the streams, you said that you found the domestic point of diversion was in a northern drainage, or based on the maps you were looking at, you found it to be in a drainage that was to the north of the operation. Am I saying that right?
Correct, yes. And I have primarily two ways to determine that initially. So when the notification comes in, it's provided again through our Ferns notification system electronically. Within that system itself, I can actually utilize various data sets, one of which is one that we are provided by the Oregon Water Resources Department, which is the stream, or the domestic use layer. So that information is provided in there, among other things, such as stream locations, the high landslide hazard locations. And so I'm able to do a review with that system to look for those and identify those resources. And if they're in an area or a condition that would potentially be influenced by the harvest operation, I would proceed with conversations with the operator and landowner to identify those resources and work through any protection measures that would be required.
Is the mapping information that you have through Ferns, well, before we get to that, can you tell us what Ferns is and how that system works?
Yeah, so Ferns, it's an electronic system that is utilized by the Department of Forestry to track all forest operations in Oregon. As required by the Forest Practices Act, any proposed forest management activity or harvest is required to be notified through that system. That provides the stewardship forester the information associated with any of those proposed harvests in that area. It also doubles as an information source for interested individuals. We call those subscribers. So as an individual can create an account and provide notice to the Department of Forestry that they're planning a harvest. Another individual can likewise create an account and simply delineate an area of interest that they wish to know if there's any harvest operations or forest activities in that area to increase information sharing and allow those folks the opportunity to provide comment on those proposed operations if they see fit.
Did you have conversations with Mr. Kroll and Mr. Lund about how to sign up for a notification?
I did in a couple occasions. So I spoke with Mr. Kroll a number of months ago, around September of 2021. I forget the exact date. And we had a conversation about that, he had inquired about any proposed operations in the Gale Speak area, which is the location of this harvest in question. And he was curious at that time if there was any proposed harvest in there, to which I wasn't aware I hadn't received any notification of at that time. We also discussed that subscription process, to which Mr. Prowl was able to successfully go in and submit a notification, like with a notice of harvest operations. I also receive a notification, if you will, of any subscribers that also pertain to my service area, my work area, so I can see that those are successfully put in. As for the other conversations, I can't recall if I specifically talked to Mr. Lund about how to do that, but I know Mr. Prowl and I had some further conversations later on down the road about that process. I do know, though, that Mr. Lund was able to get a subscription. Again, I received a notice that he had filed a subscription, as well as a new one from Mr. Prowl on, I believe, February 16th of this year, February 16th of this year.
Does a member of the public need to renew their subscription each year to continue to get those notifications?
They do. Just as with a proposed harvest notification, all notices or all requests, if you will, through the furnace system are only good for a calendar year. So there is a process or requirement there, both for the harvest side and the subscriber side, to re-up those notices or subscriptions, if you will, at the beginning of each calendar year.
And so I got us on a little bit of a tangent to talk about ferns, but you had said that with the point of diversion, one of the first tools you looked at is within the fern system, where you're checking to see what protected resources show up. Is there another tool available to you to look for protected resources?
Yes. So we have an internal system as well called Vantage, another mapping system. It crosses over all of the same information and data that we have in ferns, but more importantly, it provides a broader scope, if you will. So within the fern system, that resource review is limited to a smaller area, about a mile within that notification area. So I'll in this case, and oftentimes I will, with the notice harvest, I'll take that to that Vantage system after doing a preliminary inspection on ferns, just to double check there's not any missing data or anything, and as well to further that scope to see if there's any resources further away that wouldn't otherwise be picked up in that initial review. And this could correlate to a number of things. One example would be streams. If just looking in the fern system and it's cut off to that 1 mile radius, you won't necessarily, I wouldn't be necessarily be able to see a water right, mile and a quarter down, which can create implications for protection measures. So I do double up on that to make sure I get the full picture of the proposed harvest operation.
Did you look at Vantage as you reviewed this notification?
I did, yeah. So in that example that I just mentioned, and to my statement earlier, there was no additional information specifically for points of diversions. It was simply the Lund point of diversion that was noted on that Vantage review, and again that further review again concluded for me that it wasn't associated with that harvest, that drainage terminated, that drainage terminated lower than the harvest area as well. The entire drainage itself wasn't located in or associated with the harvest itself.
And the locations, you could say again, where does the data come from that is inputted into Vantage?
So for the water, or for the point of diversion data specifically, that comes from Oregon Water Resources Department. They provide that information to us, which we then directly put into those two systems that we utilize. So that data isn't managed or manipulated by ODF. The Water Resources Department manages that, and we collect updates from them periodically. With my role as stewardship forester, there's opportunities that I'll be out on the ground and might see something that differs, and so I will oftentimes share that information if it's something that I find and can be utilized by those other agencies.
In this situation, did you later learn that there was a discrepancy between where the actual point of diversion was located and where the maps showed it to be located?
I did, yes. So preliminarily, again, since ODF can't make that call, we rely on Oregon Water Resources Department to provide final confirmation of those locations. But I did find a point of diversion associated with the Lund residence, not or different than what was mapped. I located that on February 18th during another review, and I'm trying to remember what exhibit that was.
Looks like, could we go to A11? See if
yes.
That one helps.
Yes, so that was the inspection report provided by myself after that review. I met with Mr. Kroll, Mr. Lund, and Mr. Caffaretta on the site, and by site I mean first to Mr. Kroll's residence and then the Lund residence. The intent there was to discuss the ongoings of the operation, as well as to collect information that had been provided that there may be a question about the location of the water point of diversion. And on that date there, I did in fact find a point of diversion coming from a stream in this case it's been referred to as Spring Branch, that led up into the harvest unit itself.
Did you map where the actual point of diversion was located?
Yes, I collected that GPS point, following that field review, I went back and compared that to again to my Vantage to the Vantage system in Ferns, and the information provided there determined that between what was mapped as the point of diversion and the location that I had just found on the ground was somewhere near 500 or 600 feet south of what was mapped, so with that I had some I took the opportunity to do some further analysis there, again looking through the Vantage system, primarily in that case, since I had become aware of a potentially different location where this water intake was. My intent there was to look at any requirements that would be required of the forest operation, given that the point of diversion was now identified as a stream associated with that unit, and with that, through that process, there's a process in which I determined the upstream extent that would require protection measures for that domestic use stream, and at that point, I was in discussion with Mr. Caffaretta as well, since he had been out there and seen the site too, we collectively called on the phone to Stimson, indicating that we had found that new location And at that point, we determined that that stream was going to be a type D and would require protection measures and subsequently a written plan process. And so we requested the Stimson halt the operations in that area until that process was seen through.
How much time passed from when you were able to confirm the point of diversion location to when you notified Stimson of the obligation to stop harvesting in that riparian area? How much time passed between those things?
Probably no more than an hour or two. I don't have the exact timeline, but I'd be confident to say an hour or two. We got back to the office and dove right into that further review. And so it was very, very shortly thereafter that we reached out to Stimson.
Did you also begin talking to the Department of Water Resources about fixing the discrepancy between the actual location and the map location?
So given the nature of the situation, there was a lot going on. I don't believe that that particular date and time is when I spoke with them. Our intent there was to begin implementing protection measures based on what we had seen and verified on the ground. It wasn't until later, on or about the 1st of March, that I was able to really start that conversation with Water Resources, to which they didn't have a concrete answer, but we did start that conversation then pursued that conversation for a number of weeks before we had a number of outcomes associated with that.
Okay. If we could turn then to Exhibit A12, if you could identify this photo for us.
Yes, so this photo was taken by myself on the 18th during the inspection, or during the meeting with the adjacent residents and myself, Mr. Caffaretta. We then proceeded up the drainage to the harvest unit. And I'm trying to think of the easiest way to describe that, but the main drainage essentially starts on the lower third right side of the screen there where you see a broken stump and progresses up at a angle towards the left corner and then up towards that V notch, if you will. Yeah, great. Sorry, I'm looking at mine as well. It's a little bit bigger. But yeah, the cursor there follows that main drainage there of what was later determined to be the type D stream. And then a tributary that cuts off to the left right there, as indicated by the cursor. Thank you. So at this point in time, we had not seen the point of diversion. We're not aware of its location. With that, looking here, it's very typical of a harvest operation of that nature, given that at that time, the classification of that stream was a type N. There are no, per rule, there are no RMA requirements for a designated small type N stream, in this case, for merchantable timber. So it's perfectly within reason that the timber could be harvested down to that stream edge. You'll also notice here, given the pathway of that stream, a number of the trees, for the most part, are within common practice there to fall parallel or away from the stream as much as possible to protect the integrity there. So with this, prior to that finding of the location, still pointed to compliance with the operation and following all otherwise expected rules at that point.
Does this photo show the point of diversion, or can you tell us where it's at in comparison to where you're standing?
It does not show that, no. So we are on the easterly edge of the harvest unit there. And I'm looking for another exhibit.
We've got some photos in exhibit 827.
27, thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll go to that first one actually. Yeah. So approximately that blue point there is more or less where that photo is taken, looking towards that green polygon or into the unit. The red dot there on the north end of the map was the location of the diversion point that we found on the ground. Several hundred feet below the unit itself. But as I alluded to earlier, with type D domestic streams, or for surface water that comes out of a stream that's considered domestic, the protection measures are attributed to the tributary, the main channel there, above the point of diversion. And we determined through review that it would correlate to about I forget my math now, but I believe it was about 2,500 feet of stream channel that would otherwise require protection for that type B classification, and what's delineated here in the green arrow is with that picture there in A12. Is the approximate area that had been cut prior to the knowledge or determination of where that physical location on the ground was at the point of diversion.
Okay. And if we could flip to page 2 of A27, is this another view of the same harvest and the same drainage?
Yes, so this is a zoomed-in view of that. And there's various components there. The orange dots are the map stream layers. That central one that runs through the green polygon is that main channel that would otherwise be afforded the required protection. The red coloration, yellow there, delineates steeper slopes, or the HL high landslide hazard slopes. That are within, or some of them. This is zoomed in, so it doesn't show at all. But those are what information is delineated there.
Okay. If we could then jump back to exhibit 813, please. Can you tell us what this document is?
Yep. So again, another inspection report provided by myself on this harvest. In this case, I had received a concern from Mr. Kroll that potentially. So this was dated 2/23, so February 23rd of this year. Which is after we found the presence of FEOD, the point of diversion, and at which point we had requested Stimson to refrain from further operations in that drainage. This was in reference to the call there, concern that those harvest operations may be continuing in that drainage. So myself and my supervisor, Eric Perkins, conducted a site visit of the operation there to determine that. What we found was ballers were working in that harvest unit but they were not in that type B drainage in question. They were working on a southerly portion of the harvest unit that did not drain into any of that area.
Okay. Then if we could turn to the next exhibit, I'm sorry, not the next one, jump forward to A20. Is this another inspection report on March 1st, 2022?
It is, yep. It followed a similar suit. There was a concern again that that operations may have been continuing in the type D drainage. This would still correlate to the timeline in which we requested that Stimson refrain from being in that drainage until a written plan was submitted. Myself, Eric, my supervisor Perkins went out there. We're able to determine again the foliage were out there. Again, though, they were harvesting or they were cutting trees outside of that drainage, that type B drainage in question, working in the southerly portion of the harvest unit. That time, we're also able to look at the buffers associated with the type D drainage. Samuel Howard had since gone out there, provided buffer around the remaining type D channel, as well as all of the tributaries off of that, which numbered approximately 3 or 4 tributaries within the whole unit.
All right, sorry to interrupt here. Mr. Kral, I see your hand is up. Oh, Mr. Kral, you're on mute.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge. I appreciate this conversation about the type D. As I mentioned before, I think there are important issues here, and they certainly are relevant. But I did want to point out that we're talking about a public safety concern here, and that really is, in my mind, the most important outcome and objective of this hearing. And this is an ongoing public safety issue. And I would just request, if possible, that we can focus on that specific issue. I would like to respond to some of the concerns around the Type D, just to provide that framework. The reason that this case exists is because of the Type D stream. But I'd like to, if possible, request that we focus on the public safety issues here, because they're immediate.
Okay. I think Mr. DeVore has indicated that he wanted to kind of give a timeline of events that led to this case, and I think from my perspective, that's really helpful to me, since I'm the one who has to write the order and make the decision here. So I appreciate the desire to really narrow this. I do, because I do want to be respectful of everyone's time. But I think kind of laying this groundwork for how we got here helps me make sense of kind of the whole, all the exhibits I'm looking at and everything. So I'm going to allow this to continue. I think we're kind of getting near the end in terms of kind of the timeline of events. And Mr. Kral, you'll absolutely have an opportunity to ask Mr. Mr. Jacobs about all this. And you'll also have an opportunity to respond to it when I take your testimony, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, Mr. DeVore, Mr. Jacobs, I interrupted you. I think you were done, but I'm not sure. So, Mr. DeVore, if you want to just check in with your witness and resume.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think that covers everything from Exhibit A20. If we could turn next to Exhibit A21. Can you tell us what this document is?
Yes. Again, another inspection report provided by myself. This was a unique one in that it wasn't direct correctly, it wasn't a direct inspection of the harvest itself, but rather an inspection of the area around the operation, if you will. So in this case, a phone conversation had been had between myself, Mr. Perkins, Mr. Crawl, Mr. Lund, and Mr. Bierman. And the intent there was to provide Mr. Crawl and Mr. Lund some additional information on the public safety landslide risk rules and the memo or the summary that Mr. Bierman had provided based on that. That essentially led to this meeting here on described here in Exhibit A21, to which those same individuals, as well as a number of others, including Stimson and neighboring residents, attended. So with this, we had the opportunity for Mike Bierman, again, the geotech, to come out and review the drainage directly above Mr. Lund's house and that which had the Type D classification on it. This didn't really focus on the Type D requirements itself, but rather looking at the conditions of the drainage and area around the Lund residence. For Mr. Bierman to get some additional information and essentially determine if there was a need to adjust or otherwise make additions to his original review that he provided to myself on January 5th. And that's what this inspection entailed.
Did Mr. Lund and Mr. Crawl provide more information about historical slides and some of the public safety concerns that they've been raising throughout?
They did, and yeah, Mr. Bierman was very involved with that. He was able to hear them out, as well as a number of those of the nearby residents as well. In addition to Mr. Crawl and Lund, they had some information as well to provide on those events.
Do you recall how long you spent and kind of geographically how much area you covered?
So with this visit, it was a meeting directly at Mr. Lund's house. I don't know if it's good to go back, but it is in reference in A6, I believe, is as one of those dwellings. Near the harvest area.
And you're saying that the house, you can see the house in it?
Yes.
Okay. Did you walk around the property or was really just a meeting in the house?
Yeah, so we started both. We started there at the house, and so to help context for everyone there, the home 7 is the one residence again. So we met at the house there, had that discussion, toured around the house, in which Mr. Lund was able to provide some context to some past slide events that he experienced. And then we proceeded to walk up the drainage towards the harvest unit. From there, approximately, I can't remember exactly. I'd say approximately 400 to 500 feet up the drainage, or up to the confluence or the mouth of that drainage. And it all entail, we're probably there, 2-3. I don't think quite 4 hours, so probably a 2-3 hour period.
Do you have an approximation of how far the Lund house is from the harvest unit?
So the point of diversion that I located on the ground is approximately 500 feet below where it was mapped, which is actually mapped kind of above the house or close there too. So I would say between those two points, the home and the point of diversion, it's about maybe 400 feet. And from that point to the actual edge of the harvest unit is an additional 1,700 feet, I believe. So close to a total of 2,000 feet above the home itself.
We could then jump back to exhibit A14. Is this the document that Stimson submitted as their written, the statutory written plan, as well as their plan for alternate practices?
Correct. Yep. This was the document provided by Sam and Howard to myself, that was provided. It was actually provided to myself on March 3rd, which is a little confusing given the date there on the document itself.
So the documents date February 24th, but it didn't reach you until sometime later.
Correct, yeah.
Did you help or consult with Stimson as they were developing this written plan?
So yes, during that process, kind of maybe stepping back for some context, during the time in which we located the physical point of diversion and then subsequently requested that Stimson implement the statutory written plan process and buffer for the type B drainage. The buffer, we discussed what was required to be buffered and what resulted was, as I mentioned earlier, not only the remaining lengths of the type B stream, but all those tributaries there listed and their corresponding distances. And there was some assistance there for myself. I reached out to some of our Salem staff, Keith Baldwin, to ensure we were able to help Stimson get all the points and information that they needed to address in such a statutory written plan. And in addition to that, one point of clarity that Stimson had asked was the rural requirements for those areas already affected by the harvest, and by that I mean the areas of the type B stream that had been cut within that RMA scope. And primarily we were looking, they were interested in getting some assistance on clarifying if any requirements associated with that would be strictly stream protection measures, or if there was any high landslide area risk or rules associated with those trees that had been cut or managing those in any way. With conversations with the Salem staff there and consulting the rules, we determined that it was a stream protection measure, and for that, we were able to assist or point Stimson in the direction of a plan for alternate practice, which is again another tool. And here, as Greg's scrolling down, was submitted in conjunction with the statutory written plan itself, proposing an activity that's not otherwise allowed by rule in the Forest Practices Act. In this case, the proposal was to remove trees cut in a protected RMA, or riparian management area.
So the Exhibit A14, is it correct to say that the first page is the statutory written plan, and then the second, third page are the plans for alternate practices?
Correct. Yep.
once a statutory written plan is filed, what is the opportunity for public comment on that plan?
Yeah, so with the statutory written plan, as we kind of alluded to with the non-statutory written plan that was originally submitted, both statutory and non-statutory written plans are afforded an opportunity for a stewardship forester to comment, again, to increase that communication with the operator, ensure all protection measures are going to be met. Unlike a statutory written plan, the non-statutory written plan isn't subject to a hearing or appeals request. So simply the timeline associated with that, those types of plans are just in which a time period to allow the stewardship forester to provide comment on that. The statutory written plans require, in addition to that, that opportunity for the stewardship forester to comment, also a period in which the public can comment as well. So this goes back to those subscribers or anyone at large who wishes to provide a comment on the proposed written plan. So there's a period, 14 days with statutory written plans, essentially which the operation can't occur until that period is seen through and that opportunity is had, followed by a stewardship forester comment period, another 7 days on top of that. So for timeline on here, the written plan, the statutory written plan here for working around the Type D stream or in the RMA there was submitted to myself on March 1st. I was able to upload that to Ferns. The user themselves doesn't have further access to Ferns once they submit that notification, other than just to view it, so they can't go in there and change that information. So this document has to be provided to myself and then uploaded to that. I was able to initially review that to make sure it met the requirements of written plans, delineating the protected resource, the plan to protect that resource, a map. So there's a number of things that are required when submitting a written plan. So I reviewed that initially to make sure that met those, and then uploaded that to the Fern system on March 2nd, which began that public comment period. The first 24-hour period after that, so that would correlate to the 3rd through the 16th is what the public had an opportunity to comment on.
In our exhibits, if we could look at A23, A24, and A25, are those the three public comments that you received in response to Simpson's written plan and
ultimate practices? Correct. Yep. Those three were received in two ways, actually. So I received one via the Fern system. There's an opportunity to provide comment directly in the Fern system, and as well there appeared to be some technical difficulties, so we were also able to accept those comments in the form of an email, to which I uploaded for tracking documentation on the notification itself as well. So yeah, I got two there from Mr. Kroll and one from Mr. Lund.
And those were both within the 14-day comment period window, is that right?
Those were, yeah. So the last day to provide comment was March 16th. All of those were received before midnight on the 16th.
Okay. We could jump next to Exhibit A28. Can you tell us what that document is?
So this document is my response to that written plan and plan for alternate practice. So on the first part of that document there, as indicated, And I, as the search and forfeiture, cannot officially approve statutory written plans. Again, I merely provide comment and guidance or assistance to the operator or plan writer in an effort to help them devise a plan that will meet the Forest Practices Act. Or if it doesn't, provide comment alluding to the fact that it won't. As indicated here under statutory written plan, my comment indicated there that following the proposed plan, statutory written plan was likely to achieve the required protection measures for the Type D stream. And then further on in that document was my comments to the plan for alternate practice. Unlike the written plan, or unlike the statutory written plan and the non-statutory written plans, these are the only plans that we can approve. So the reasoning behind there is again, these are plans that are proposing something that's not already in, that's not, or proposing something that's not in rule necessarily, or is an alteration of that rule to some extent. So these were the comments I provided in response to that, as well as approving the plan there on March 23rd. That time stamp there corresponds to the stewardship forfeiture window, which I mentioned. So following the 14-day public comment period, there's a further 7-day period in which I'm allowed to, the stewardship forfeiture is allowed to review any public comments that come in, and further review the plan itself, and take all that into consideration before making my final decision there, and providing these comments. So that was the 7th day there, the last day that I was required to provide notice or required to provide comment.
Focusing on the plan for alternate practice, can you tell us, and let's start with the first paragraph of that plan, can you tell us what led to your conclusion that these were the appropriate comments to make?
Yeah, so starting off there, as indicated by the rule set there, 642-400, so that's the forest practices requirement to retain all trees within 20 feet of a Type D stream. Within that rule set, sub 700, it does allow an operator or landowner to propose alternative requirements or vegetation management objectives as they pertain to this rule in question, the 20-foot RMA or the 20-foot tree retention rule. On this, one of the grounds I was consulting with our Salem staff, which advised that due to ODF not providing initial or informing the landowner of that Type D stream prior to the knowledge that there was no. Essentially no grounds for enforcement there on the operator, on the landowner. Once that resource, that Type D point of diversion was located and determined, subsequently then the process ensued for the written plan and protection measures. In addition here, once that information was found, relayed to Stimson, the landowner, as I mentioned, they went ahead and buffered in excess of what would be required for protecting the stream. So in this case, there's a certain distance of the Type D stream above the point of diversion that requires protection on or close to 2,500 feet. Within the harvest unit itself, that only correlated to about 700 to 800 feet of that upper reach of that 2,400 feet. So that area had been that upper 800 feet or so had been harvested or had been cut already before the knowledge of the Type D was relayed to Stimson. After that, they buffered the remainder of that stream, totaling over 1,100 feet, all of which would not ordinarily be required in rule for a Type B protection. It's beyond that distance scope that requires the protection. So that, in addition to the number of tributaries that they also buffered, both of which met the standard 20-foot buffer and actually exceeded that in many areas. Part of the vegetation retention for a Type B stream includes any trees leaning over the channel, in which case that 20 to 90 foot buffer included that. So there's a number of trees identified by the Stimson forester that met that category. So then that buffer, not only in length but in width, met or exceeded, or in this case exceeded, the requirements that would have otherwise been afforded by the Type B classification.
And then regarding the second paragraph with the wood loading and trees that had been downed, can you talk about what led to your comments there for the second paragraph?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, there had been some questions about what the proposed by Stimson, what this rule set really entailed. Was it high landslide concerns, or was it stream protection? So in this case, I went to Mr. Buren again, asking if he had any recommendations or considerations given that pertaining to the trees that had been cut and were otherwise felled in that RMA, to which he indicated that if a landslide were to occur in that material that was in that stream or in that RMA, it could provide a number of concerns, primarily focused on stream itself and downstream components. Should that either be caught in a debris flow or cause any backup of water or other material that could create compounding effects should that break loose. So that was one consideration going into that comment as well. Another is throughout the rules, stream rules, the operator is required to clean out the drainage as well. As forest operations occur, trees break and branches break, and sometimes that material ends up in or near the drainage. And so it's a requirement to clear that material out. Additionally, RMAs are notoriously difficult or challenging to reforest, and so with all that material in there, it was a concern from Stimson's point to work in there with that material in there to try and reforest that site and get that site revitalized in a timely manner. And so all those considerations kind of came into play there for me to relay that comment, in which ultimately the goal was to create a situation or create an environment that met or exceeded the original paragraph there, but the additional area was buffered which exceeded the rule set there. And in this case, on the second paragraph, the focus there was to revitalize that area of the Type B stream that had been impacted. So as a Type B stream, it's important. This isn't a fish-bearing stream, but similarly, tree canopy from standing trees, provides shade, helps with the water. With the trees having been cut, it didn't really provide that benefit. And so in this case, the plan was proposed to create a situation or manipulate that area in a way that would reestablish that site to those beneficial conditions as quickly as possible.
Did you and do you now believe that that second paragraph and removal of those trees was consistent with Mr. Buren's analysis and recommendation?
I do, yes.
And did you have conversations with him prior to putting that recommendation in your comments?
The conversation I had with him were to the extent of his take on removing or leaving that woody material in the stream channel, to which he provided those recommendations. I further consulted with other Salem staff, primarily Keith Baldwin, on all of these comments that I've provided here, to which that I received further recommendation from Mr. Baldwin that that was a key component as well, and beneficial to describing the plan at hand to include that removal for the wood loading concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. I don't have any other questions. No other questions at this point, ALJ. Thank you.
Okay, great. Let's talk just a little bit about cross-examination of this witness. We're about 10 minutes to noon, and I want to try and figure out if we should try and plow ahead with this witness or take a break. Mr. Kroll, starting with you, are you going to have many questions for Mr. Jacobs?
I do have quite a few, but I'm hoping they're mostly yes/no answers.
Okay. Do you have an estimate of how long you think it'll take for his testimony from you?
I wouldn't want to underestimate it. I don't want to cut it very short. If he wants to share more, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes.
Okay. All right. That gives me a good idea. Thank you. Mr. Denley, are you going to have many questions for Mr. Jacobs?
I'm not going to have many questions. I'll take about 20 minutes.
About 20 minutes. Okay. Mr. Gray, are you going to have any questions for Mr. Jacobs?
No.
Okay. Thank you. So we're looking about 40 minutes plus or minus. Mr. Jacobs, I know you had some conflicts this afternoon. What time do you need to be done by?
Three at the latest.
Okay.
So with that timeline, I don't think that should be an issue.
Okay. All right. Well, I think this, maybe then this is just a really good place to stop for lunch. We're almost at noon, and then when we come back, we can pick up with cross-examination and then move on to Mr. Buren's testimony, and then see where we are. Let's talk a little bit about how long for lunch. I propose 45 minutes, but we could go longer or shorter if anybody has any feelings either way. Does anybody propose longer or shorter? Okay. Sounds like 45 minutes then is agreeable. All right, so we're at 11:55. Just for ease, let's say 12:45, we'll all return from lunch. And during the break, I'll place my computer on mute, stop the video, stop the recording. The parties can either just put themselves on mute and stop your videos, or you can go ahead and leave the conference and then come back in shortly before 12:45, whatever's best for you and your setup. Any questions before we break for lunch? Okay. All right. Well, and I hope everyone has a nice lunch. We'll resume at 12:45. Thank you.